Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. As we were chanting the evening chanting in Pali just now, it occurred to me that the last time I chanted the Yoso, the opening homage, in Pali was inside the middle of the Great Pyramid in Egypt, and the last time I chanted the Iti Piso was at the Coptic monastery of St. Makarios, which was founded sometime in the 5th century, I think 460 something, to a Coptic monk who'd done some of their chanting with us. And the Great Pyramid was built somewhere around 3000 BC, give or take a few centuries. The monastery of St. Makarios, was not just founded 16 centuries ago, but has been in continuous use, has been continuously active since then. So this journey that I was given the opportunity to make with Lumpo Sumedho and others in Egypt, just having got back last night, left Egypt 2 days ago, still not quite in this time zone. I think it's about 6:30 in the morning in Egypt at the moment, so I haven't quite adapted to this this time region yet. This was a very interesting and rich time to spend traveling, being in a completely different environment, being with Lumpo and the others, particularly Ajahn Vimalo, who is an expert in all things Egyptian, Egyptian ancient history and religion. He's been studying since he was 10 years old. And particularly the sense of human culture, the human religious spirit having been cultivated by these peoples, carried on in that part of the world for, with a great deal of refinement and focus, commitment, and incredible physical representation in these great buildings, the pyramids, the ancient temples of Karnak and Luxor and Philae, temples of Abu Simbel, and these kind of famous places. It's very very powerful and interesting being immersed in such a strong and focused culture that's in a way so different from the Buddhist culture of our own tradition, our own monasteries, our own Buddhist lands. Particularly, on the one hand, the culture of the ancient Egyptians and the pharaohs and the religion of their times. The first of the pharaohs being recorded at 3100 BC, so more than 5000 years ago. And then the Coptic Christians, that are the same ancient Egyptian race, with the advent of Christianity in Egypt, then the country became Christian from about the 5th century through till the time of Islam in the 7th century. Now these strong cultural presences, these Coptic monasteries out in the desert, they are the places where the hermits went off to shelter from oppression from the local peoples, and to live in the desert and to meditate, to pray. Now these well-established institutions are still carrying on their life very much in the same ways as they have done over many centuries. The sense of ancient development, the sense of continuity, the sense of commitment, taking a religious form, taking a certain structures, and those having been invested in, having been a source of faith, a focus for direction in life, and still carrying on to the present day, particularly for the Christians, still a live, living tradition. The monasteries in the Western Desert, there's about 16 active today, many of them with many dozens of monastics. So very much a living tradition. And then the religion of the ancient Egyptians, maybe they're not people practicing that in the same way, but certainly it's thoroughly studied and explored and heavily represented in the many, many temples and tombs and all the different inscriptions and sculptures, statues, the murals and all of the hieroglyphic writings. So even though there's no people practicing that same kind of religious system, its traces are still very, very strong and now still pretty well understood. So it was an interesting experience being so immersed in the presence of such strong religious traditions that are, in a way, very contrasting to Buddha Dhamma, but also carrying some similar resonances. In the eyes of many Coptic Christians, and this is from the experience of a good friend of mine, a Church of England minister, who I know quite well, who's an expert on Coptic Christianity. When we were trying to arrange a visit to these monasteries of the Western Desert, he said, "You know, the Copts, they don't really do interfaith very well. It's really, basically, you're either a Copt or you're one of the lost." And that they don't really have much communication or connection with any other religious group at all. And certainly when we went there and visiting these about three or four different monasteries on one day when we went out to the Western Desert to Wadi El Natrun, to the monastery of St. Bishoy and El Surian and St. Makarios, they kind of showed us around and were very polite, but certainly they didn't really register that we were anything remotely similar to what they were. That even though we occasionally pointed out that our monastic order was 700 or 800 years older than theirs, you could see it just sort of, the words were heard, but they just didn't land. It was like, well, you know, but you're not really religious, so you're not really monks like us. And so there was this a kind of non-acceptance or sort of non-appreciation of what kind of commitment or tradition we came from, until we were at the last place, Makarios, and we one of the lay people with us asked the monk to do some chanting in the Coptic language. Which he did a little bit, and then he asked us, "Is you can you chant also?" And so we chanted the Itipiso, and apparently I had my eyes closed at the time, but about halfway through the chant, whereas this monk had been sort of polite but distant, we got about halfway through the Itipiso, and one of the people with us said, "Yeah," something in him just sort of woke up, and his face brightened, and he smiled, and there was this recognition, "Oh, well, they are monks of some kind." Not quite sure exactly what they are, but they've definitely got the monastic spirit. And it was through the quality of chanting, the recitation of an ancient language and verses from the scripture that touched that point of recognition of commonality, even though the theology and philosophy is radically different. There was a point of focus, a point of connection that he could recognize, and that there was from that time on there was a much greater sense of closeness and friendship and interest. And even though he was very clear to point out that we were we had seriously wrong view, since our life was based on meditation to know ourselves, and their meditation was to know God, capital G. I didn't point out that maybe that could be seen as being the same thing. I didn't even risk that. But it was certainly there was many points of contact. And when we were about to leave, and someone said, "Could we take a photo?" He says, "Yes, take a photograph, group photograph. This is a historic moment." Which Ajahn Vimala, who was with us, who'd been at these same monasteries 20 years before, said, "This is really different." He said, "The last time when he'd asked to take a picture of one of the monks there, who was a friend of his, he said, the monk responded with, 'We don't allow pictures of dead men.'" A monk is dead to the world. You said goodbye to the world, so you're dead to the world. So he said, "We don't allow pictures of dead men." But this was something of a shift. Or different aspect of things, and that this monk, even from such a radically different tradition, could discern a commonality. Similarly, sitting in the middle of the Great Pyramid, you have to sort of go in through these tunnels and crawl through a long ascending narrow passage to get to the funerary chamber of the pharaoh Cheops, whose tomb it was, right in the very center of the pyramid, and it reminded me a lot of being at the Mahabodhi temple in Bodh Gaya, actually, because on one level it's the sort of spiritual center, and there's a great natural sanctity and peacefulness there, a great sort of focus of energy. But there's also chaos of activity, because there was dozens and dozens of other tourists. They only allow 250 people to come into the pyramid a day, but they were all coming in at the same time as us. So huge troops of Japanese tourists and people coming in chatting taking pictures, which they weren't supposed to do, but people did vigorously anyway. So there was this, just like at the Mahabodhi temple in Bodh Gaya, where the place of the Buddha's enlightenment, on one level it's an incredible peacefulness and powerful energy there. But there's also, in Bodh Gaya, there's chaos of activity. You've got Tibetan chanting coming over the PA, you've got groups of Chinese pilgrims chanting with their mantras, and you've got a whole massive crowd of Sri Lankans on one side doing their puja, and then a large troop of people from Vietnam, and then Burmese and Thais, and everyone sort of jostling for space and having their little pujas on all sides and arriving and leaving, and even with that, the great cacophony of activity, that still somehow, even though there is all of that energy and variety and noise, that didn't seem to interrupt the peacefulness or the basic fundamental serenity of the space under the Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya. And so similarly, there in the center of the pyramid, there was this tremendous focus of energy, and he had the sort of a whole little gang of New Agers sort of meditating and doing little healing sessions, and you had the sort of chatty tourists and the different little clusters of people. It's a smaller chamber; it's maybe a quarter of the size of this room. But yet, even with all of that, there was this immense peacefulness, this incredible quietude and stillness, and really great acoustics. So one of the things that you find with mingling in different kind of religious traditions is the quality of silence, being able to look inwardly and to using the religious forms to find that inner quality of silence, that inner attribute of focus and awareness, that the whether it's in the presence of a temple, you know, in a church, in an ancient shrine, like in one of the old Christian churches in Cairo, was a place where Jesus and the young Jesus and his mother Mary had escaped into Egypt. This was a little grotto where they hid out, and it's now the place of a church. So whether it's some sort of holy shrine, or whether it's in the middle of a pyramid, or under the Bodhi tree, or on top of Mount Sinai, where we were on Tuesday, these different external insignia, the forms, the presence of these religious images and locations, that there's a way that they catalyze that turning inward and that strengthening of those inner qualities of alertness, of energy, of focus, concentration, of reflectiveness, wisdom, and of faith. You know, and how one colors the faith is according to one's own tradition or one's own affinity with different teachings. But these are at least from my experience, that these being in these different holy places, it triggers and galvanizes the spiritual faculties, and that crosses traditions, that crosses different faiths, and that those qualities of invigoration and peacefulness, clarity, are something that, you know, everyone can tap into, everyone can relate to, and in a way they go beyond religious forms and structures. And one of the things that we learned about and is are very, very obvious in the ancient Egyptian religion is that a huge amount of energy and effort was focused upon the afterlife. That this is the main interest or the main focus of attention is on providing for the afterlife. They didn't have a philosophy of rebirth, but more one of resurrection, and so that they considered that, you know, this human life is brief and not insignificant, but extremely brief compared to the amount of time that you're not going to be alive, and so that providing for the afterlife is a cause for an enormous amount of energy and effort and expense to be laid out to ensure that there's a very, very long period of time is as sort of comfortable and beneficial as possible. So but even though they have a philosophy of resurrection and the afterlife rather than rebirth, still, there's a huge focus on how we act in this present life. Yeah, that's the key piece. There's definitely a recognition of laws of cause and effect, so that according to Egyptian mythology, as after we die at the end of this human life, then you stand before the judges, the deities of the Egyptian pantheon, and you're asked a whole series of questions. And they are things like, you know, did you ever hurt anybody? Did you ever steal anything? Did you betray your spouse? Did you commit any kind of unlawful act? So, meeting with the karmic results of one's actions. And in the mythological forms, your heart is weighed against a feather. So yeah, the judge of the dead, the goddess Mart, has a scale, and on one side is a feather, and on the other side your heart is put, and your heart is weighed, and if your heart is heavy with any kind of unskillful action, any kind of unwholesome karma, then that outweighs the feather, and then you're in trouble. So that. Because on the one hand, if you get past the judges and you make it through that region and you get approved and you make it through the 12 gates, etc., 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 then what awaits you is eternal paradise, you know, some beautiful, blissful existence forever. I asked, of course, the obvious question is, well, what happens if you don't get through the judgment? You know, what happens if you fail the judgment or you don't get through the 12 gates? And then at first they said, well, you know, for some people it goes very, very quickly, and other people it takes a long time to get through the judgment. And I said, yeah, well, even if it takes a long time, still, you know, they're getting past. What happens if someone doesn't qualify? Well, if their karma is too dark, then what happens? He says, then according to their mythology, the soul is, quote, lost in the chaos of eternal darkness. So when they passed on that, that sounds like a bitter enough option to cause one to reflect, and a kind of great sort of sobering of feeling. So that even though they have this, you know, somewhat different mythology from our understanding of karma in Buddhist teachings, still that general sense of encouragement towards skillful behavior, and that I found that image of weighing the heart against a feather, a very, very beautiful one. And to consider, you know, what does that mean, or what does that feel like in our own experience, you know? Because it's also very easy when you look at the imagery, and you have these deities with the heads of animals, you know, the crocodile-headed god, or the lion-headed goddess, or the Anubis with the head of a jackal, or the Horus with the head of a falcon. You know, you can say, well, these are obviously, you know, foolish pagan religions, kind of a very sort of basic and coarse religious understanding, and, you know, who would want to be guided by gods with, you know, a half animal? But this is a question of religious symbolism, and, you know, one can take it literally, or one can look at it in a superficial way. And just as one can, you know, one can look at some of the imagery you get in other Buddhist traditions, like particularly Tibetan Buddhism and Northern Buddhist iconography. You have flaming demons, you know, deities with eyes all over their bodies, with bulls' heads, with all kinds of weird and wonderful appearances. And you say, you know, that's a representation of ultimate wisdom, this sort of, you know, bull-headed deity with colored blue surrounded by black flames. That's some kind of transcendent wisdom. How can that be? It looks like kind of a weird sort of animal god to me. So one can take these images and reflect and say, well, how does this relate to one's own experience of karma? You know, how do we look at our own actions? How do we judge our lives? And in Theravada Buddhism, in particular, there's, you know, the understanding of Hiriyotapa, that the what are called the bright protectors, Hiriyotapa, the sense of shame, sense of moral sensitivity, sense of right and wrong, and that this is a weighing of the heart that doesn't have to wait until the body dies and we're up, you know, face to face with all these, you know, weird deities with strange animal heads, but this is what this kind of judgment, or this kind of exploration or investigation, we can apply, and we recognize this is what guides us in life, you know, all the time. And when we meditate, when we sit down at the end of the day, we consider the actions and speech, the attitudes that we've held during the day. This is the same kind of weighing of the heart. This is the heart on one side and the feather on the other, and we notice if the heart sinks, then it's a clue that there's attachment going on. There's something that we love, something that we hate, something that we have opinions about, we have things that we're struggling against, things that we're hanging on to. This is what weighs the heart down. It's difficult to know exactly what the sort of spiritual trainings or the more wisdom, you know, wisdom traditions there were that existed within the Egyptian religious world. But certainly, as Lumpur was pointing out as we went along, that it's important not to judge others' religious forms by our own cultural conditioning, just as, you know, we might think, oh, this is, you know, they're obsessed with the afterlife and they have these wrong views about resurrection and they don't believe in rebirth, or or they have this, you know, strange mythology about having your heart weighed against a feather, and that and the obsession with, you know, say filling tombs with treasures and things to provide for the afterlife, you know, that they had also this belief that they had to have five elements together in order to guarantee a successful resurrection, which was the body, the heart, the name, the spirit, and the soul. And the spirit, or the ka, was represented by the image of the person's face. And so those had all to come together. So in the tombs you had the body and the physical heart, the name would be inscribed, the ka would be represented by the person's face, and then there was a lot of the objects of that were familiar to the person, or representations of things that were dear to them or close to them, or images of them, in order to give the soul a sort of a good purchase, a good sort of homing signal to not get lost and to come together with those other four elements. And you can say, well, that's all kind of rites and rituals, that's all just sort of conventional belief, that's all just superstition, it doesn't really mean anything, it was all just kind of nonsense for the credulous. And then you're seeing many of these temples with different images, and then the all the different deities and mythological stories, and you can say, well, that's all nonsense. But so one has to consider that when people come to a Buddhist monastery and they see us doing puja and bowing to the shrine, they think, oh, we're worshipping a statue, and that we're appealing to some deity, because we're facing towards the shrine and we're bowing down to it. You know, that looks pretty kind of superstitious and based on credulity as well. So it's important to consider, I felt, and it was really interesting traveling with Lumpur and Ajahn Vimala in particular to reflect on those the inner traditions or the inner qualities of the religious forms that were represented there, and to recognize that that quality of the immortal, of the recognition of the possibility of transcending life and death, that the movement towards realizing the immortal was a crucial thing in their lives, to realize that which is beyond death, to establish the heart in qualities beyond, that are free from the bondage of death, and that in seeing that, what they would characterize as lost in the chaos of eternal darkness, we would say, caught in the round of rebirth. We would say the heart entangled with avijja, with unknowing, with ignorance, hindered by craving, fettered by ignorance, hindered by craving. Round and around the cycle of rebirth we go. So there's certainly differences in the mythology, differences in the religious forms, but that recognition of, if we guide our lives in a skillful way, if we live skillfully, then the realization of the immortal is possible. And if we live in a confused or chaotic, selfish way, if we live immorally, if we don't live according to truth, according to doing the the right thing according to the values of the society and what is in accord with nature, then that quality of the immortal, that quality of the transcendent, can't possibly be realized. Well, and I'm fully aware it's dangerous territory to be aligning things fully and completely across religious traditions, but certainly there were some resonances there, and that and I found myself interested to see more, to understand more deeply what kind of wisdom tradition that they did have. Because just as you can come into a Buddhist monastery or temple or look at Buddhist iconography and you can take it in a superficial way. Buddhists believe in things in a superficial way, but in the wisdom traditions, in the development of insight, the practice of wisdom, then there's a recognition that within Buddhist practice, that there's that all sankharas are impermanent. They're not self. They're empty. But yet we still use the sankharas of Buddha images, of chanting, of keeping the Vinaya, and in the northern Buddhist tradition in particular, a highly developed system of images and deities and bodhisattvas. But yet the wisdom traditions point to the fact that these are, yes, there are these forms, but yes, they are all empty. And my suspicion is that within the Egyptian tradition as well, there was as you have within the Theravada world, a small core of those who understood also that these forms, these deities, these traditions and practices and rituals, that they're important to carry out with sincerity and faith, but they're all also ultimately empty, and that these are external forms that are there simply to help awaken those inner qualities that really do open the heart to transcendence, to purity, to reality. Because also, if you consider a religious form that carried on pretty much in a single unified pattern for 3,000 years, you can't, this adherence to rites and rituals couldn't sustain that kind of focus for 3,000 years. It just is too, human beings are not so stupid. That they're just to be carrying on in patterns of ritual for 3,000 years, one feels that there had to be a core of understanding, that there was an engine of true realization that was functioning at the center of that, was helping keep all of the forms attuned to the fact of reality, the actual truth of the way things are. Also, similarly, in another of the places this resonated was in some of the images that there were of the deities and the pharaohs, that many of them, particularly from the new kingdom, about 1200 BC, so 3,200 years ago, some of the images of the pharaohs and the deities were of such purity and beauty, that they were incredibly similar to many Buddha images that are of the most refined qualities, like the Saranath Buddha, the Dhammacakka Buddha from Saranath, that is so well known and so highly regarded and sort of as being the most sort of perfect of forms. In many of the images of the pharaohs, particularly some that we saw in the museum at Luxor that were only discovered back in the late 80s from a cache of images that had been hidden away to save them from being destroyed by invaders. They were hidden under the courtyard in the main temple at Luxor, only discovered in 1989 during some routine digging there. And some of these images of the pharaohs, particularly Thutmosis III and Amenhotep III, and others of that era of the New Kingdom, extraordinarily beautiful, and fine, incredibly balanced. And so what one saw is that looking into their faces, looking into the face of the of these most refined and beautiful of Buddha images, this is the image, the symbol of human life perfected. And that these are not rather like Buddha images. They're perfect human forms, but also they're not personal, so that the images of these different pharaohs are not cast into the, like with individual characteristics of this having a kind of a long nose or a short nose or a square jaw or a narrow jaw. But like Buddha rupas, there's a stylized quality, but also extraordinarily balanced and perfect in form. And it's like a Buddha image carrying the sense of immense power and strength, but also the quality of immense serenity and peacefulness, and a gentle half smile, a kind of peaceful, serene, contented expression, along with the sense of immense power and strength. So when one looks at those images, even though this is, say, on one level, the image of a human being, a monarch, it was also part of their mythology that the pharaoh was the presence of the divine in the human world. And so it's just as a Buddha image is a representation of the transcendent, the pure, the holy within the human form. But similarly, those images served a similar purpose, that they are a representation of the pure, the holy, the divine within the human, cast in a human form, and that within that balance of proportions, within that expression, within that symmetry and beauty, there's something in the heart that stops, and that is in that moment their personal concerns, self-obsession, personal loves and hates just naturally fall away, and there's a quality of wonder. The heart is open to something that is beyond the personal, beyond time, beyond place, and that space that the heart opens up to when in the presence of such things, it, again, that transcends traditions. It's that that space within the heart that is known when the clinging stops, when the personal concerns interrupted, laid aside, that even to some small degree, that's the same space within all of us, whatever at the surface level is our language or our cultural conditioning or our religious affiliation, that the mind that goes quiet, the mind in the quality, in the state of awe, in the state of wonder, apprehending that beauty and that peacefulness, is a primal human quality. And so that just in being in the presence of some of those images, also very close up in the museum, was that particular museum, also the Museum of Cairo, that you could really be face to face within a foot or two of these wonderful images, and so have the opportunity just to appreciate what was embodied there through the hand of the sculptor, their own attunement to their spiritual tradition, and the truth of the way things are that they were tapping into, and then representing through that perfected human form. Also, I'm aware that it was a very brief visit, only a couple of weeks, and taking in 5,000 years of history in 2 weeks is quite a like swallowing a whale. But and it was really not until I actually was sort of on the plane and flying in over Egypt itself and seeing the land underneath us, and then waking up in the at the hotel in the early morning and seeing the literally Great Pyramid outside your hotel window, like, oh, this is Egypt. Didn't really hit me until then. It was so so different, so unknown, so unfamiliar. So I don't pretend to have any kind of in-depth knowledge or real deep sense of how their spiritual traditions work. So I can only speak from just superficial impressions and initial sense of being in contact with these places. But certainly, I did appreciate the opportunity to dip a toe into these ancient traditions, these ancient forms, and also to appreciate the debt that Western culture has from the Egyptians. So many of the things, just even down to building techniques, let alone religious imagery and language, come down from those early times of human development in this part of the world. It's a sense of appreciation of our ancestry and the conditioning that has come down, the gifts that came from that culture, and also just the quality of anicca, the sort of fading glory, that it was all so powerful and important, and now it's gone. You know, that which was gathered such immense strength and power and commitment to those forms, it's gone. No one has a belief in those same religious forms anymore. No one worships those deities anymore. No one carries that on. It's all gone to empty temples now, populated by thousands of tourists and visits by school kids. It's all gone. That which seems so important and so real and so valid, that a huge proportion of the nation's wealth was poured into unstintingly, it's gone. It's all dissolved. That which is seemingly so valid and meaningful and potent. So that was, in a way, one of the most powerful teachings. Was that how structures and forms that seem to be so real and so significant, so fantastically strong, you know, carry on, you know, the pharaohs who were living just like, say, 500 BC, they knew they were carrying on from 2,500 years. Like the first pharaoh was as long before the Buddha as we are after the Buddha. It's really old tradition. But then just seeing how even something that was that strong, that continued in basically a single form for 3,000 years, and psh, it's just empty temples and blocks of stone, images of human figures out in the desert. So that's in a way the most powerful of teachings, is that anicca sanya that comes from that it reflects back to all the things that one feels are so significant in one's own life. You know, that your body or your religious faith or your family or the place where you live or the projects that you're involved in or the kind of community you belong to. It all seems so real and so important and so valid, and you know, there before you is these, you know, that kind of sense of importance or commitment multiplied thousands of times over. And now it's just, you know, rocks in the desert coming in, being looked upon by strangers. Or forgotten, you know, dissolved, you know, lost under the sands, gone. So that anicca sanya, the feeling of you know, nothing can be held onto, nothing can be sustained, you can't keep anything, you can desperately try to hold it all together, to provide for eternity on the material level, but it can't be done, it all fades, it all dissolves. And one of the most poignant things is in the Cairo Museum, they have mummies of 15 of the greatest pharaohs, all these kind of mighty beings who had these huge, huge temples, incredible wealth of gold and silver and jewels gathered together with them. And they have all their mummies, basically, in their underwear. A few kind of raggedy bandages, all sort of laid out, you know, quite neatly together in one little chamber in the museum in Cairo. after all that, you know, huge tombs and incredible effort to hide these things away and to surround them by all these emblems of immortality, and now it's just sort of 15 shriveled bodies wrapped up in raggedy bandages with hundreds of people coming to look at you in your raggedy underwear. Ajahn Vimala was very happy to see them, and in a way you could see that was it was had its own uses, but it was also a powerful perception that no matter how hard you try to sort of protect your image and make sure that things go your way and that your body is kept in, you know, within a coffin within a coffin within a coffin within a coffin, your layers and layers of gold and sealed away in tombs with trap doors and false passages, and still you end up stacked side by side with out in the open view. Just another shriveled body. Yeah, the great Rameses II, Rameses the Great, who even gave himself the title God of Gods, and put himself up with in his own statues and representations, put himself as the same size as the deities. Built, you know, the whole temple at Abu Simbel, 4 gigantic statues of himself, temple at Luxor, you know, whole huge chambers just with images of himself all around it. Rameses is the kind of megalomania gone into overdrive. But there he was, laid out in this his mummy there, stacked up with the other 14 or so of his family. Just another shriveled body wrapped in raggedy old bandages. No matter how hard we try to preserve the self or to create a self-image and to hang on to it, it dissolves, it breaks up, it leaves us, it can't sustain. So that's in a way what I come away with from that is this, the sense of tremendous impetus to not claim, to recognize any of those the different manifestations of self-creation, of hanging on to an opinion, a view about ourselves, a view about others, a solidity of an I going through time, even when we don't want to sustain it, to see it can't be sustained by wanting, by not wanting. It all dissolves. There's nothing that can make it cohere. It all departs. It all leaves. And that in that leaving, as it says in the chanting, Te sang wu pa samo sukho, in the passing of all sankharas, there is peacefulness. So that's one of the great blessings or the gifts I found from this journey is just that the tremendous strengthening of the anicca sanya, that nothing can be held onto, nothing can be sustained. And that there's when we open the heart to that, then what we feel is great relief. There's sukho, there's ease, there's happiness, there's peace that comes when we let all of those structures die, let it all fade. Our plans, our self-image, our opinions of others, the things that we think we possess, the things that we think we do, or we have behind us, we have before us. It's all just more dust blowing in the desert. There's nothing there. Can't be held onto. And in this passing it's not depression and loss. But if we apprehend that anicca, that impermanence, that insubstantiality with wisdom, then what remains is peacefulness. What remains is sukha, ease, and contentment. So I offer these thoughts for consideration this evening. Adama.